Right, James, we're back again. I've got a little gem for you this time, which I hope you're going to enjoy. I think you will. It's been quite fun researching it, and I think it's pretty interesting, but let's see. So today's gem from the archives was born on the 21st of January, 1869, in Pokrovskoye in Siberia. Now, wow. You can probably think half a dozen people, you know, off the top of your head, you know, famous people from Siberia, can't you? But let's not put that to the test, just to spare your blushes. Our subject today was a religious figure, semi-religious figure, sort of unofficial, a mystic, faith healer, who became an advisor and influencer at the highest level in pre-revolutionary Russia, and ultimately became a close confidant of the Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, and especially the Tsarina, Alexandra, Mrs. Tsar, to you and me. And you may or may not be shocked to learn that he had a rather grisly end. Any thoughts on where I'm going?
Well, this has thrown me already. As you know, my knowledge of where Russia is probably the first stumbling block. But I'm going to say someone like Neville Chamberlain.
It's a good guess, I guess. No, it's not Neville Chamberlain. I mean, do you think Neville Chamberlain was born in Pokrovskoye in Siberia?
Well, you know, there's a high chance of that, I think. You know, looking, as I do, through an extensive range of historical magazines.
I don't know what magazines you're looking through, but I mean, Siberia, right, central, in central Russia, is a long way from the UK. It's kind of level with the top of Scotland, and then all the way east as far as Pakistan, and then to the north. That's where we're talking anyway, so not really Chamberlain country.
It's a bit of a stretch.
This person's initials are GFR, and probably known generally by their last name, beginning with R.
GFR. That's interesting. Are we in American territory?
No, this is a Russian, James. It's a Russian. Siberia is in Russia.
Russian, right. Okay.
Sinister, a beard, a lunatic. That could be any Russian, I know. But
is this a real person? It's not a fictional kind of character. It's not Popeye's mortal enemy, Bluto.
No. He is a bearded person. No, we agreed to do real people, because if you're just going to make up life and death of made up people, that would just be a nonsense. So this is a real person. Okay. Grigory Yefimovich Rasputin.
Rasputin. Lover's greatest love machine. Him.
Indeed. Of the Bonian classic. And we'll come on to his appearances in popular culture a bit later on. And there have been many. He's an enduring figure. So what does Rasputin mean to you? So you've got the Boney M song about Rasputin, loosely.
Yeah.
What else?
That is probably where my knowledge ceases. I originally thought that he was some kind of character in a rare Sherlock Holmes novel, The Mask of Rasputin, which I suppose leads me to the idea that he is a kind of comic book villain who tried to infiltrate the Tsarina and her wardrobe. But I genuinely don't know a lot about him, other than I suppose he gets into that category of assassination attempts and things being done to him and trying to be knocked off, a bit like Castro's exploding beard, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you've hit on a number of popular themes there to do with Rasputin. He certainly appears in comic books. I don't know about Sherlock Holmes novels. You've kind of hit the nail on the head there with your vague remembrances. Although, interestingly, I think most of your knowledge is kind of based on listening to late 70s Eurodisco. That's kind of your main lens for looking at the world, isn't it?
It is that. And also, as you know, a lot of the sort of references, a lot of the knowledge that I accumulate over time, my main sources are things like the Reader's Digest holiday specials that come out, but also The Lady. The back pages of The Lady are fascinating, particularly if you're looking for sort of wrong or revisionist history about people.
I'm not going anywhere near that. Let's move on with Rasputin's early life, and then we'll look at his rise to power, and of course we will thoroughly enjoy his grisly death. Early life, actually, there's not a lot to say, to be perfectly honest. It's not especially interesting. Not a huge amount about it is known. He was born into a poor family, blah, blah, blah. But when you start looking into it very quickly, you realize with Rasputin that there is a strong theme around him of rumor, myth, storytelling, fabrication, propaganda, allegations, lies, deceit, you name it. He was a very controversial figure in Russia. So both at the time And since, there have been a lot of propaganda built up around him. His story really starts. So he's born in 1869. His story really starts about 20 years later, in his late teens. 1897, he went on a pilgrimage. And some people say he was inspired to go on this pilgrimage by a religious vision. Some say he ran away to avoid prosecution for stealing a horse. We don't know. We don't know for sure. We don't know what happened to the horse. The horse's account of this whole thing is totally shrouded in mystery. So, you know, I'm not sure we'll ever get to the bottom of this horse business. We may come back to that later on. But anyway, he visited a monastery. He stayed there for several months and underwent something of a religious conversion and returned home as a kind of slightly wild holy man. And he started then to develop a following locally and started to be a man of sort of potency that could help with sort of spiritual problems and healing the sick. And he was sort of one of those wild sort of preachers and so on. So he started to build his reputation in that way. There were early rumors of sexual misconduct with his female followers. Some people say they just used to wash him. Others have said he used to shag them. I don't think we really know.
Or both.
Any thoughts on that? Yeah, both. Why not both? Yeah. So, well, but they were allegations that of inappropriate behavior.
He is an enigma, isn't he? What you're describing, I guess. And I suppose absolutely. Just to try and help the listener relate this to sort of modern day figures, you know, that they might cast in a sort of Rasputin bracket. I guess really you're describing someone who is a kind of mix of Dominic Cummings, the Marquess of Bath, and David Icke, if you could imagine those three jumbled up together in a bearded lunatic.
That's not a bad shout, actually. Yeah, I would chuck in a soupçon of Oswald Mosley into that, but that's a pretty fair, I think, mashup, actually. That's good. So over the next kind of 5 to 10 years, his reputation started to gain traction with local sort of senior church figures and so on. And he went to St. Petersburg, the Russian capital at that time, where he had been recommended to visit a bishop, kind of around 1903 to 1905, that sort of time. And he made a big impression on this bishop. He really kind of won him over with his amazing stuff that he did. He then basically commenced on a pretty rapid rise to power and prominence. You know, he became a man of influence around the royal court. He developed a number of prominent followers who sought his advice and so on. And, you know, throughout this period, as he rose to power and influence, there were continuous steady rumors of him sleeping with a lot of women, drunkenness, strange behavior and antics, rituals, all sorts of, you know, muck was flying around. Again, whether any of that's true, whether it's all true, we just don't know. And some of this was dreamt up afterwards as well. But the epitome of his power was really his connection to the Tsarina Alexandra, Mrs. Tsar, and his involvement with her son, the Alexei, the son of the Tsar, who suffered from very poor health. I think we now know that he had hemophilia, you know, the thin blood problem. And Rasputin treated Alexei for this condition between sort of 1906 up to 1912, 5-6 years, kind of successfully. And he became during that period an indispensable member of the Tsarina's entourage. There's been a lot of research into what he may or may not have done to this boy. And what some researchers have argued that what Rasputin did was that he kept the doctors away from the boy, and the doctors would have given him aspirin for pain relief, which thinned the blood, which made his hemorrhaging worse. So when Rasputin came in and kicked the doctors out, he actually got better. So that's kind of how the sort of rationalist sort of medical researcher historian would possibly look at these events. Others might suggest, and this may be where you are sitting, others may suggest he invoked the power of Christ or possibly the power of Satan to heal him with, you know, religious magic. Just for your benefit, I'm wiggling my fingers, you know, in front of me when I say religious magic, just to kind of emphasize that. What do you think of that?
Well, I think I'm glad you've said that, because that's kind of reassured me, really. And again, going back into some of the what we'll broadly call shenanigans, I suppose. I knew, for example, about some of the allegations about playing Siberian Leapfrog with sons of the Russian royal family at the time. So some of that was apparent
sons,
to me.
Sons, you say?
I can't say too much, but in today's language, we'd probably call it a multi-use games area. I think that's probably how we would describe it. And I'd probably say more about the royal court there. But I suppose the other thing, the kind of, was he Christ or Satan? I suppose, really, he's sort of bigger than both, I think, is probably the revelation I'd put on the table. Because the figure and the idea of Rasputin has become a sort of, you know, it's like doing something that's Machiavellian, isn't it? You know, you kind of, I've often said to people, stop being Rasputinist in your work. You know, I say that a lot to people. And generally they don't respond. So it must be very offensive. I'm basing it on that. But he's still, this is quite a long time ago. We're talking, what, nearly sort of 80, 90 years ago since his sort of prominence, I suppose?
Yeah, he's a very enduring figure. Yeah, this was in the kind of early 1900s up to 1916, where things backed off a bit on the account of him being dead. Yes, well, this entire period of his sort of treatment of Tsarevich, the son of the Tsar, remains a mystery. It's essentially a mystery. You know, we don't really know what happened. And there were lots of other people that he ministered to at the time. And we don't really know the truth. We don't know the truth about that horse that he stole. I mean, did he fondle it? You know, I mean, I'm just putting it out. We don't know. Maybe he just killed it and ate it. You know, little details like this about his life, we will never know for sure. Between you and I, we can piece together a very, very accurate history of exactly what happened if we allow for the fact that, you know, anything we might come up with is then accepted as fact. So that's probably our only real hope of accurately, you know, recording what he was up to. But he was a controversial figure. He rose to power. He attracted enemies. Like all people rise to the top, they attract enemies because they inevitably trample on people as they go. And there were plenty of people around the Russian court. Kind of one of the early sort of shots across the bows is in 1909, back east, back in Siberia, one of his early followers, a lady called Kaonaya Berlatskaya, accused him of rape. It's a very serious accusation. She's not sure she actually got anywhere with that accusation, but rumours were starting to build in the media that he had abused various of his followers, and possibly he'd been up to no good with some of the ladies in the court with royal connections, possibly horses. We don't know. But just to give a comment on that, you know, there was a lot of media speculation, but one point to note in the historical context is that Russia at that time was in a very bad place. It was the build-up to World War One. There was a massive arms race across Europe, but Russia was absolutely broke. The monarchy and aristocracy were very, very unpopular. The communist revolution was building. The Tsarina Alexandra was a German. Mrs. Tsar was a German. And there were lots of journalists and commentators in sort of Daily Mail fashion that made her and Rasputin into hate figures, you know, secretly controlling the Tsar, that sort of angle. And particularly with Alexandra being a German and a foreigner, you know, there was a lot of interest in that. So the key point is he'd built up some powerful enemies. He was becoming very unpopular and people thought he had a sort of insidious influence over the Tsar and the Tsarina. They took action. Would you like to move now, James, to the death of Rasputin?
I think I would. I would just say, before we move to it, I think, you know, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, that Russia could ever be in that place when you look at it as, you know, sort of the strong economy it is now, the beacon of truth. And also some of those things you described about, you know, people's response to people being German or people from other places, you know, that kind of xenophobia. Thankfully, we've moved past that in the modern era.
Big relief, isn't it? Big relief that you no longer have insidious authoritarian figures dominating the political scene in Russia. That's a big relief for everybody. But yes, on to the demise. Okay, you mentioned assassination attempts. You are correct. Attempt number one. In 1914, a lady called Chionya Guseva, maybe you and I might call her the Goose, she attempted to assassinate Rasputin. She was inspired by a former follower of Rasputin and a priest. And this poor lady was kind of in some way induced into assaulting Rasputin. She stabbed him in the stomach in the street. He was seriously wounded, but somehow survived a stabbing to the stomach. This is a very unusual occurrence. And it possibly this event added some fuel to the legend that there was something kind of supernatural or evil about him, because he recovered, but he did recover.
It's probably his truss, I would have thought, would it? He had a supernatural truss.
he was treated in hospital and had an operation, and that didn't kill him. So that's interesting. I mean, I don't want to cast too many aspersions on the Russian healthcare system in the 19-teens, but I imagine it was rather rudimentary. Although, of course, he was a very powerful and influential person, and they might have been frightened to do anything too, you know, nasty to him. So there's no mention of a truss.
A cummerbund?
Might be one of your... No mention of a cummerbund. Okay. Or a suit of armor, or anything like that. He was, all I know is he was stabbed in the stomach by the goose.
Well, what a way to nearly be killed, but not.
She just a little byline in history. The goose Chionya was not prosecuted for the assault because she was found to be insane.
Fair enough,
isn't it? So you know, let her off. Then 2 years later, in December 1916. A group of conspirators led by three men, a prince, a royal duke, and a politician, formed a plot to murder Rasputin. And the prince was Prince Yusupov. And it's his account. He gave a written account of what happened on the evening of 30th of December. And that's kind of the account that has generally been received as what happened. There are others that dispute this, and there have been heavy disputes of what went down. But this is the account by Prince Yusupov. Rasputin was invited to the prince's home, a palace, on the evening of 30th of December 1916. He was offered tea and given some cakes that had been liberally laced with cyanide, more than enough to kill him easily. Rasputin ate the cakes. Nothing happened.
Supernatural powers again, maybe.
He asked for some wine. He was given some Madeira wine, ghastly stuff. He was given some Madeira wine, which had also been liberally poisoned. He drank three glasses of this wine. Again, no ill effects whatsoever. Yusupov, at this point, he got a bit irritated. He's getting a bit annoyed. So he went upstairs. He got a gun from one of the other conspirators who were all hiding upstairs. He got a gun, a revolver. He came back downstairs and shot Rasputin in the chest at point blank range.
That would have done it.
Then, in an Agatha Christie novel style little sort of episode of subterfuge, one of the conspirators called Sukhatin put Rasputin's coat on and his hat, and the three of them drove to Rasputin's lodgings, pretending that he sort of travelled home safely and kind of went inside and took the coat off and came back out again and went home, laying this false trail down, you know. So in an episode of Columbo, this would have been happening in the first few minutes of the show, wouldn't it? We'd been shown all this.
The glass eye would have been twitching at that point, wouldn't it?
But there was a small problem. There was a problem here, because when they got back to the palace to deal with the body, Rasputin leapt up. He fought them off and he legged it. He wasn't as dead as they had previously thought. He was rather less dead.
Extraordinary.
He made it outside. Yeah, extraordinary. He made it outside into the palace courtyard, where he was caught up with by one of the gang called Puriskevich, who shot him dead again. The difference being this time, however, at this point, he was actually really dead. The gang then wrapped him up in a cloth, took him to a bridge and chucked him into a river. So a fairly ignominious end to Rasputin. He was found the next day about 200 yards downstream under the ice. There was a post-mortem of him. This is interesting. The post-mortem found no evidence of him being poisoned. Whether he was poisoned, but somehow he magicked the poison away, or whether the poison, the cakes and the wine weren't poisoned, as Yusupov had thought, we don't know, or something else, we don't know the details there. In the post-mortem, they did find three gunshot wounds, including one to the forehead. That must have caused at least some inconvenience. And then just finally, he was buried just outside St. Petersburg on the 2nd of January, a couple of days later. And then in March 1917, Rasputin's grave was exhumed by soldiers, and his grave was completely empty. Only joking, not really. No, he was in the grave. But
anybody else in there with a horse in there?
That's a very good question. There is no mention of the horse being in there with him.
Yeah, I see.
So whether he'd already done away with the horse, or whether the horse had immigrated, again, you know, these are the questions that we just don't know the answers to. These are the right questions. The soldiers burnt his body and destroyed his grave, and this was about stopping the grave becoming a shrine or a rallying point for the Tsar's regime. So that's kind of the way he went. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a remarkable story, and there's a couple of things I'll just sort of want to say in response to that. One is it does lend credence to a popular online theory that Rasputin was in fact king of the cat people. So the amount of times that his life was threatened, or that he would have, you know, anyone else would have been from that dodgy cake, and certainly the Madeira wine, they would have been killed by that. But he had nine lives.
Or so, the stomach stabbing.
The stomach stabbing, those kind of things. So he survived that because of his feline actual sort of DNA. You know, he was actually one of a larger litter of cats who wanted to overthrow the Russian imperialists at the time. So it does add credence to that. Some of the ladies you've mentioned as well, I believe, did make some films and magazines alongside some of their sort of work at the time, which again, I don't know whether Rasputin was involved or not. There are allegations about the use of his beard explicitly in some of those publications, which we can't go into obviously on this podcast, but we will email you the pictures if you contact us. But it's an extraordinary bit of history, isn't it, really, that, you know, this kind of shadowy figure, this kind of unknown, manages to get so much power, but also creates such a kind of myth around him, you know, and becomes a kind of almost like a supervillain. In fact, I'm pretty sure he's appeared, as you said earlier, I think he's appeared in comic books, hasn't he, as a sort of, you know, with Nicotine and others, you know, that kind of thing.
He is a very enduring figure in popular culture. There's been loads of films about him. I'll mention two: Rasputin the Mad Monk, 1966. This was a Hammer horror film starring Christopher Lee as Rasputin.
Wow.
Lee later said about it, the only way you can present him is as the way he was historically described. He was a lecher and a drunk, and definitely had healing powers. So he was a saint and a sinner. He also went on to say, Rasputin is one of the best things I've done. Sadly, I think that may well be the case. I've not seen that film, but that's interesting. But what do you think of that Christopher Lee quote? He definitely had healing powers.
Well, I think it probably alludes more to Christopher Lee's probably bank balance at the time and him needing acting work. But you would think in what you described that Oliver Reed would have been the perfect cast person for that.
Well, you say the other film I'll mention is Rasputin, Dark Servant of Destiny in 1996, which was a HBO kind of film, where Rasputin was played by Alan Rickman.
Wow.
And I think he is an ideal, a superb actor, you know, ideally placed to play somebody who sort of with the intensity of Rasputin. Obviously, he would have worn a fake beard. I watched a documentary about Alan Rickman recently, one of these Sky Arts specials, which is very good. And it's very interesting, you know, just kind of goes through his career and people say things about him. And they featured this film for about, I would say, 20 seconds in a 1 hour special, which in itself is kind of a commentary about it. I haven't seen the film, obviously never will. But then in terms of other media, well, TV, comedy, sci-fi and fantasy, comics, theatre, music, you know, the lot. Even 100 years later, he's still featuring in these things. We've already mentioned the famous Boney M song, Ra Ra Rasputin, which is a song about him. It's fairly sympathetic towards Rasputin, or at least the first 1 minute and 16 seconds is. I could not bring myself to listen to any more of that and switched it off. But the first minute or so is kind of sympathetic towards Rasputin. It basically says he was a fiery preacher and a really sort of hot dude that the ladies loved, but he was too much to handle and they got rid of him. That's basically the sort of take of the song. Is that how you recall it?
Yeah, I guess. And again, it comes back to that sort of Christopher Lee quote, doesn't it, about the sort of the healing powers. So, you know, when I listen to that song, it does give me several peculiar feelings across my body, and I get a real healing sense from it, you know. And I think Rasputin, if anything, should be remembered as, you know, a soulful funkmeister whose power on the dance floor was perhaps greater than anything in the royal court.
Yeah, there's very little recollection of his dancing prowess. I mean, we can assume that he would have been pretty tasty on the dance floor. I think the beard alone indicates a degree of competence dancing. But again, let's, you know, put it on that long list of questions that have never been properly answered. The only other thing I was going to say is that the comedian Richard Herring, who I'm a fan of, as you know, he performed an Edinburgh show called Ra Ra Rasputin in 1993. And he also put on a play at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2014, as recently as that, called I killed Rasputin. 100 years, 98 years after your death, if people are putting on plays about you, you have definitely achieved something.
It's an accolade, isn't it, really? That, you know, you can only hope for that kind of level of stardom, really, I suppose. You know, even if you're a ruthless and unscrupulous murderer and liar, you know, amongst many other misdemeanors, you know, it's still, I think it's a compliment, isn't it?
I'm not sure I'd call murder a misdemeanor. I think, just to pull you up on that point, I don't think there's any suggestion that Rasputin directly murdered anybody, although, of course, he was himself the victim of murder. And the murder is technically unsolved. I don't think the conspirators were ever actually properly brought to justice, because the sort of tumult shortly after his death with the Tsar standing down and the revolution and everything in 1917, it was kind of, you know, I don't think... this almost kind of slipped by, you know, so it is technically an unsolved murder, even though I think we've got a good, fairly good idea of who did it, because you know, one of the conspirators wrote it all down and published a book about it a few years later. So it's not a gigantic mystery, but that's the way he went.
Hello, I'm Jack Humphreys.
And I'm Danny Denson.
And this time round, we want to give you some great tips and advice on weddings and matrimony. As I've said time and time again to my fourth wife, Eunice, marriage is one of the most important institutions in modern society, if only she'd listen.
Remember that weddings are supposed to be a fun celebration, so have a couple of extra stiff tots of brandy for one's breakfast.
That's right, and there's nothing more natural than two young scamps unified together under the watch of Godfrey.
It's important to dress very smartly, so bring that tatty old dicky bow back to black with some delicious lead paste, and give your old suit a good brush down with some asbestos.
And at the wedding breakfast itself, usually sausages, egg, pine nuts and stoat's kidneys, it's customary to throw a plate at the groom and toast the family every 5 minutes, usually with a local mead, or a good slug of Cornish whiskey.
Did you know, Jackie, bit of an old family secret, that you can clean up your top hat a treat with some liquid mercury? And if you'll take my advice, smash a couple of swigs down while your butler's not looking. You'll feel absolutely on tip-top form, with only a minor risk of blindness and death.
And remember, presents are always tricky, aren't they? I like to go traditional, with a Montenegrin lover's seat and a Dutch nephew for the larder. Simply bliss.
And don't forget to clean out your pipe thoroughly.
In English shires, it's customary to ask the father of the bride for her hand in marriage, or at the very least, for certification from the Ministry of Agriculture.
Always kiss the bride on both cheeks and on the side of her face, but don't linger for too long around the happy couple, especially if you've shed yourself, which can happen in the afternoons.
And now, Jackie, let's talk about the wedding night, which can be full of discovery and anxiety. So here are my tips for a successful eventuality. Firstly, keep one foot on the floor at all times. Secondly, ensure that you retain your stock and garter, no matter how tempting. And finally, administer Mulgrave's Prussian Blue to the bedpost before commencing activity. Passion shouldn't be hindered by friction.
Yes, and keep a careful eye on the best man. Make sure he doesn't have too many swigs of the old cooking oil before 9 a.m. After that, let him get f***ed as a judge, that's what I say. I will have my chauffeur collect me at 7 p.m. on the dot, and then keep the ruddy working class blighter waiting until gone midnight, just to show him who's boss. Oh, and he'd better bring you a couple of spare pairs of kecks due to shating.
But that really is excellent advice, isn't it, Danny, for a long and fruitful matrimony, and also some lovely presents from those filthy parasites you have to call friends. That's all for now. See you again soon.
Pip, pip.
Let's now move to our second giant of history. And this is someone who I think you probably know fairly well, but you probably don't know. It's one of those kind of characters. So we're talking now about an actress who came from a fairly theatrical family, I think it's fair to say. So her father had what was called at the time a song and dance act. I think we'd probably call it a tantrum or an act of a fray now. But I think what they mean is that he tread the boards. You know, he had a song and dance in his step and all those kind of things. And also this actress had a fairly famous cousin, which does set the tone really in terms of where she is in our history. So her cousin was Clive Dunn, who people will remember not only as granddad in the kids TV series, but also as Captain Jones in Dad's Army. So you know, we're kind of, this is the kind of level, you know, we're really on the A-list to start with.
I can't James, I can't let that one go. Corporal Jones, not Captain Jones.
No, I gave him the wrong rank, but there you go. I sort of demoted him, promoted him. I'm not sure.
You promoted him. That's your natural anti-authoritarian streak coming through. But okay, so the clues so far are that it's a lady, a female lady, who was from a showbiz family and had and her cousin famously was Clive Dunn. I've got no idea. I'm going to need a lot more information. It's not someone like flipping Olive from On the Buses, is it?
As I said, we are A-list here. We are talking A-list.
Okay,
this we're not on the L's. So her break, really, I guess, came during World War II, where she stepped into a number of review shows. So, you know, popular entertainment at the time, a kind of variety mix, a review of dance and song, and, you know, a little, maybe the flash of an ankle, you know, that kind of thing. And she was involved in some of that ankle flashing because she herself was a tiller girl at the London Palladium. Now, that's not a euphemism for another service. A tiller girl, I believe, is a dancer, a leggy kind of can-can dancer, you know, frills and spills, those kind of things. Hopefully not too many spills, depending on the audience that are in. But she toured initially in this review show, which led to her work with the Gracie Fields show. Okay, so again, you know, she's kind of mingling with some of the great and the good at the time. And really, I think it kind of sets the tone for her work. You know, she starts getting into the theatrical world, and she starts moving from some of the perhaps slapstick and comedic things that are involved in that kind of Palladium review atmosphere to taking on more serious roles and doing more serious things in theatre, including things like Verdict by Agatha Christie. So in the late 50s, she plays Mrs. Roper in Verdict. And it's a big hit. You know, people love it. Now, Verdict's something that's completely passed me by and I've never heard of before, but I'm sure it was excellent at the time, as most things are. Now, as you know, what happens when you tread the boards so well is you get scouted, don't you? Film companies come along and they watch what's going on, and then they decide to, you know, sign you up for feature films and those kind of things. So our subject here, she starred in many films. Of the list of films that she was in, I've only heard of one of them, okay? Which, again, I think talks to the caliber of this actress. So she was in things such as Cloak Without Dagger in 1956, The Murder Game in 1965, The Night Visitor in 1971. I've no idea what that was about, but I'm hoping that Robin Asquith wasn't in it. And The Three Musketeers, which we've mentioned before in our last podcast, she was in that film in 1973. But really, I think it's fair to say that television is her platform, and that's where she becomes best known and best loved by all of us. Now, I'm going to tell you one fact here, and then I'm interested to know if you're any further down the path of guessing who this great loved actress is. So this is a lady that played in 1965. She played the original Mrs. Alf Garnett in the pilot episode of Till Death Do Us Part with Warren Mitchell, the sitcom that went on for perhaps too long, written by Johnny Spate, but she played the original Mrs. Alf Garnett. Have you any ideas yet who this wonderful lady is?
No, I haven't got the faintest idea. When you said Tiller Girl, I immediately thought of Bessie Boothroyd, the MP, who's the only Tiller Girl I can think of. And then everything else you've said since then has led me down the garden path. I haven't got the faintest idea who you're talking about. Are you still clinging to the preposition that this is an A-list actress, by the way?
This is...
Because I think that's getting a little thick.
On the list I have in front of me, with A at the top, actress is obviously at the top of that. She is an actress at the top of that list. So she's still, in my mind, she's one of the most, I guess, quintessential British actresses that, you know, comes to mind whenever I think of some of the leading roles.
So it's not presumably Dandy Nichols, I think, who played the Mrs. Garnett in the series, long-running series. So it's not her, and I'm guessing that. So I've ruled that one out. No, you need to give me a bit more. I haven't got a clue. The kind of clue I probably need is her name.
We'll come to that very shortly. So Dandy Nichols was a lifelong friend of this lady, mainly because they met around the time where She was offered the part of Mrs. Alf Garnett, but couldn't take it because she was contractually obliged in some of her stage roles. So unfortunately, she would have been, I guess, known as Alf Garnett's other half. But Dandy Nichols was recommended for that part by this lady. So, you know, kind of forged a friendship there, if you like. And that was a long time ago, 1965. Now, from that, after she came out of the stage work in the theatre, she began to enter into the genre of work of which we would best know her. Okay, so she began to take on TV roles, which started with Crossroads. Okay, if people listening aren't entirely sure what Crossroads was, it was basically a very low budget soap opera set in a motel, ostensibly with a cast of people that couldn't act, I think. The sets were made out of cardboard, and I don't think they ever went outdoors. So that gives you an idea of kind of quality of that. She was in Crossroads as Myrtle Cavendish. So again, I'm giving, I think, probably too many clues away here, because that's a name that will instantly spring to your mind.
Can I just confirm you are not giving away too many clues? Because I still don't know.
Okay, she also played Mildred's mother in George and Mildred. Again, a key part. And crucially, she played Aunt Maud, Rigsby's Aunt Maud, in Rising Damp. So you would have seen her and thought, oh, that's her. She's great. Okay. She was also around in Dixon of Dock Green and Zed Cars. She appeared in Danger Man with Patrick McGowan. And also in the, I suppose it's a bit like the kind of Inspector Morse of its time, but with an equine bent. She was in Follyfoot, you know, the great drug-crazed, addled horse detective.
James, you are aware that this podcast is going out in 2021, not 1974, aren't you? Go on, keep going with the drama, because it is interesting.
These are all important facts that help colour the canvas of who this lady is and who she became. In your mind, once I reveal, I'm going to build to the reveal soon. Once I reveal who she is, I think you will be shocked, mesmerized, I think is probably the word I'd like to use there. So really, she took on her most famous role to date. This is where you will know this lady from, in 1985, with the launch of the BBC's new soap opera at the time, EastEnders. Okay, so hoping you would have probably seen EastEnders at some point. It's essentially a melodrama set in a very downtrodden part of the East End of London, but it doesn't seem to be very representative of the East End of London, and it's always raining. It's a bit like a kind of Pinter play, but with a carry-on take, I think, just for a bit of context, if you've not seen it. So she appeared in this EastEnders, and really she was in it solidly for several years after that, and has been in it ever since until her demise, sadly, which was in 2005. So I am, of course, talking about Little Ethel, played by the absolute A-list actress Gretchen Franklin.
Right. Yeah, very good. Yes, I do. Of course, I remember Ethel and her dog, Willie, from EastEnders. And thank you for the description of EastEnders for people listening to this from, you know, Pluto. I was vaguely aware of it already. Yes, Gretchen Franklin, did you say? Was that her name? Yes, I do. I do remember her. And I just, in the back of my mind, I have a kind of very hazy recollection of her playing Mrs. Garnett. But other than that, the rest of her career, I'm afraid, has totally passed me by, mainly because for most of it, I wasn't born.
So you mentioned Willie the Pug, okay? Now, Willie the Pug obviously was a bit of a prop, I guess, a bit of a sort of a straight dog. It allowed her to make several malpropisms about her Willie, and her Willie being cold, and Willie needing to be wrapped up, or Willie poking out of her coat, you know, those kind of things. So it added real sort of, I think, intense humour to EastEnders
all
at the time.
We're comic gold. I mean, let's not get away from the, you know, the cleverness of that writing and the, you know, sort of shocking, sort of you know, the daringness of such outrageous jokes on a programme that went out at 7:30 p.m. in the week.
Well, I can remember as a young boy vividly being affected by Ange behind the bar. In the Queen Vic, saying to her husband, Dirty Den, "Oi, stop stroking Ethel's willy." I can remember very vividly. It's had an effect on me. But we'll move past that anyway, because I want to get to the important elements of her character, because obviously it's burned such a impression on your life, and obviously people listening, you know, they will remember Gretchen Franklin now that we've revealed her as Ethel from EastEnders. And she was involved in a rather controversial storyline, I think, in terms of how they eventually wrote the character out of EastEnders. The writers of EastEnders at the time wanted to put Ethel into an old people's home. They wanted to get rid of her, essentially, and sort of fade her out and bring her back now and again. But this caused Gretchen Franklin to resign from EastEnders. She said, I don't want to do that. I don't want Ethel to become this little sad old lady who you only see sort of stuck in an old people's home and not really a kind of central character. So she stepped out of the show, and she made a couple of appearances across the sort of late 90s. But importantly, in the year 2000, she returned, and she returned to a little bit of a scandal and intrigue. Of course. So you'll remember, if you've seen EastEnders at any time, Doc Cotton is one of the key characters for EastEnders, played by, again, another A-list celebrity actress, June Brown. And they were firm friends throughout. Ethel reappears at this time, telling everyone of a horrible terminal illness that she has, and she appeals to Dot to help her end it. So she introduced this idea of euthanasia to popular primetime tea time viewing for a family audience.
Well, do you know, I've no recollection of that at all. Even as you say that, I'm thinking, nope, it doesn't ring any bells. But then I think I watched about three episodes of EastEnders in the late 80s, and probably since then, I mean, you know, sort of 20 seconds every 5 years or something like that, which is, you know, kind of enough to keep up with the story, but not enough to really kind of have a strong handle on what's going down. Interesting. The challenging concept of euthanasia presented to a primetime audience. I think that's worth exploring. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, these are issues that we need to be talking about. And if we can do that through medium budget, fairly opaque television, I don't see why we shouldn't. We shouldn't be afraid to grasp it. Now, I wanted to get to her demise, okay? The nub of our conversations here in the way they went. And as you know, people who've listened to our previous podcasts, we're trying to explore the deaths and the circumstances of deaths of well-known people to really not to sort of put the bellows in and get the last laughs out of it, but really just to reflect on their lives and to find out what really their contribution was to society. Now, Gretchen died at the ripe old age of 94. She pretty much died of natural causes, really. I think she just died in her sleep, sadly. But the controversy, I think, around the EastEnders role is really interesting, because obviously in that, Doc Cotton helped her to end her own life. And there's a really interesting story here where Gretchen in some ways missed her own funeral, if you can get your head around that. So any ideas what I'm alluding to there?
No. Go on.
Okay, so Ethel's funeral on the programme in EastEnders was watched by around 15 million people in 2000. But Gretchen herself admitted in an interview that she didn't see it. She missed it. She wanted to watch it, but she forgot to watch it. So she missed her own character's funeral on television.
Well, I mean, that's quite an admission. I mean, it must have been a pretty, you know, pretty impressive occasion. I mean, I think you can put me in with Gretchen there, because I missed it as well. 15 million people watched it. I mean, the thing with a funeral, I mean, we've talked about funerals previously. You know, they're relatively sort of predictable events, if I can be so bold, because, you know, you kind of got a rough idea what is going to happen. 15 million people is a lot to watch a fictional character's funeral on television. There must not have been much else going on at the time.
I think it really, though, puts in context how well-loved she was as a character, I guess, and as a character actress. I mean, do you, for example, remember her in the original Blackadder in 1983? In the end of the first episode, The Foretelling, she appears as the witch Cordelia, for example. Is that something you would remember?
I'm a big fan of that show, and even the unpopular first series, I think, is actually very good, albeit the production values are relatively modest. No, I don't remember her in that part. But you skipped over something of interest, which is her character Ethel's demise. kind of at the hands of Dot Cotton. I mean, you know, assisted suicide is technically murder, I think, so or you know, something like that. So what do you recall what happened there? How did she actually pass away, and what was Dot's role, and were there any consequences for Dot?
Well, I think there were discussions between the two of them. They were firm friends. I think the characters were really close in the series, but obviously June Brown and Gretchen Franklin knew each other from review and various other theatrical roles. I believe Dot went down the line of trying to poison the cake and using the Madeira wine in a similar way that we heard of Rasputin's, you know, the kind of assassination attempts there. There was, I think, an idea of using a shotgun, but obviously to film that and to put that across at around a sort of 7:30 on primetime BBC One, quite difficult to do tastefully, I think, although not impossible. I mean, if you can remember Arthur Fowler wrecking the family house at Christmas, you know, quite tastefully done.
EastEnders was familiar with some very sort of torrid scenes. So, I mean, you can just imagine the conversation where Ethel says to Dot, looking, and I've got this nasty disease, cancer or whatever, I don't know. And I'm going to, you know, I'm looking at a fairly grisly 6 months. Would you help me? I've got this, you know, I've got this shotgun. I don't think that was a serious proposal. I think you may have departed from the facts. I mean, a cushion, you know, held over is kind of one thing, but I can't imagine Dot wielding a shotgun and blowing Ethel away. I mean, to start with, you know, the authorities are going to have to be exploring whether that was assisted suicide or something rather more blatant. Do you not think?
Yeah, I guess so. And I think in the end, they went for the safe option where Dot assisted Ethel moving on to pastures new by giving her a massive overdose of her drugs that she was on with, I think, some fortified wine.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So that's probably, if you were going to do that, then that's probably a bit more reasonable, and certainly visually perhaps not as stimulating as a murderous attack with a shotgun, but probably cheaper to film. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
So Gretchen Franklin there, the way that she went.